Well, in a moment, Joe Nickell joins us. The modern Sherlock Holmes, as we talk about his latest work, The Science of Ghosts. Stand by for that next on Coast to Coast AM. While he was on with me 4 years ago, Joe Nickell is regarded by many as the world's only professional paranormal investigator, a former stage magician and private investigator for a world-famous detective agency, among other personas. He's also the senior investigator for Skeptical Inquirer Science magazine. And here he is back on Coast to Coast with his latest work, The Science of Ghosts. Joe, how are you?
I'm good, George. Thanks for having me back.
I'm looking forward to this. What have you been doing over the 4 years besides this book?
Oh, other books. I'm cranking them out at an alarming rate. Last year I did a book called Tracking the Man-Beasts, which is a record of my looking for Bigfoot and similar creatures that are created in our image, you know, man-like monsters, vampires, werewolves. Went to a castle in Austria where there was a torture chamber, and two unfortunate young men had been tortured into confessing they were werewolves. You and I would probably have confessed to
words. Yeah, that's right. Oh, my gosh, unbelievable.
Books, doing investigations, that's the bedrock, and then I do lots of TV shoots. Did four last Saturday, and
good for you.
Keep busy.
Well, you got to.
Ghosts and flying saucers and psychics and
keeps you young, Joe. You
know, I'm trying to explain mysteries, George. As we've talked before, I think so many people divide into camps of, believe or disbelieve. And as a former detective, I'm trying to actually investigate and actually explain pretty much the same way you would go to a crime scene and try to, you know, not just assume somebody had committed suicide, but actually investigate the case.
That's right. Now, it's not accurate to call you a debunker, Joe, is it?
You know, I get called that a lot, usually by people who've raised their voice. But if one means by debunking that one has taken the actual bunk out of something, of course, that's a great thing to do. The Amityville Horror hoax, sure, I debunk that. But if it means that you set out to debunk, and there are people who call themselves debunkers who don't really investigate, just sort of know, in quotation marks, oh, that's a bunch of hooey, then I distance myself from that attitude. Because if we're going to criticize people who start with an uncritical belief in something,
right,
then isn't the flip side of that just as bad? Isn't it just as bad to start with one answer as another?
Sure is.
And in fact, though, of course, I debunk case after case by explaining them, but I'm interested in the correct explanation.
I assume you would love to find that real paranormal experience.
I would. I'm discouraged after all these years that it may not happen. But sure, I mean, I remember when my grandmother died and how much I didn't want that to be the case. So I absolutely understand people wanting to believe in ghosts, or, you know, that extraterrestrial life is sure a possibility somewhere out in the vastness of the universe, and wouldn't it be nice if we are not alone?
Mm-hmm.
And if psychics can really tell me about tomorrow, who isn't apprehensive about the future? Wouldn't that be a good thing? So, you know, I'm there ready to raise my hand if we were voting, but science is not in the voting business. It's in, okay, where's your proof? Where's your evidence? And I'm doing that difficult work trying to actually investigate cases.
So we could call you a healthy skeptical researcher.
I hope so. I think, you know, I have people who dismiss my work and who call me names and so forth. And I'm confident every time that happens, that they have not picked up one of my books and actually read it cover to cover. Mm-hmm. Or they would absolutely, I mean, they would go through the details of investigations that I carry on sometimes for months or years. And they might disagree with me, but they would have to admit that I did an awful lot of work and have earnestly put forward an explanation. And I'm not just name-calling, dismissing, and hooting at.
Have you, in all the cases you've looked at, Joe, have you come across any case where you couldn't explain it, you had to put it in a special file, Stanton Friedman would call it his gray file, that you couldn't say, okay, by scientifically I know what caused this, but I just don't know?
Well, that's my most frequently asked question, I guess, because it really does get to the heart of things. The problem is, I mean, the short answer to your question is I haven't, if what we mean is those cases where I've had a fair chance at the evidence. But there's the rub. So many cases, the Shroud of Turin, for example, we've talked about this, I think, once before.
Right.
I'm not allowed to come and examine the Shroud of Turin with my experts. So, and a lot of evidence is not readily available on the Shroud of Turin. So I'm at a disadvantage. Nevertheless, I managed to pull the iron out of the fire there. But people tell stories. If somebody comes up to me and says, okay, Mr. Skeptic, I was driving near Peoria. It was 1962, and I saw this fiery UFO zip across the sky and execute a right angle turn. So you tell me, what was that? And I just say, I have no idea. And they say, see? Well, no, there's nothing to see. I wasn't there. There's no evidence. It's not admissible in court. We just have a little story somebody's told and probably misperceived something and has embellished it subconsciously over the years, as we all do our stories. So the problem is that in any case, the paranormal is primarily promoted, I think. I'm let you in on what I think is the great secret of the paranormal. Mm-hmm. And that is that it's all being promoted as, in a negative way, is what's with a logical fallacy called an argument from ignorance. And it goes like this. We don't know what the bright light in the sky was. Therefore, it was an extraterrestrial craft. Or we don't know what the noise in the old house was. Right. Therefore, right. It was a ghost. And so on. But in fact, if we don't know, we don't know.
And it could be, it could not be.
That's right. But it's not for me to, because I can't prove you didn't see a leprechaun, doesn't mean that leprechauns are just as likely as not, or that I somehow have lost an argument or whatever, because the person claiming the leprechaun has to prove it. So if somebody says they saw an extraterrestrial craft, I mean, they're really making kind of an outlandish statement if all they're saying was they saw something in the sky and they don't know what it was.
Well, and with the evidence that you go out and investigate, I just want to throw out an example. We're going to talk about many with the science of the ghosts. But let's say that you are covering a UFO case. I would have loved had you been able to have interviewed the late astronaut Gordon Cooper, who claims beyond a shadow of a doubt what he saw was extraterrestrial a long, long time ago. And it would be difficult for a lot of people to refute his authenticity because of his background and who he was. But that would have been a great case for you, because I would have loved to have seen what you came up with.
Right. But we have to be careful that because someone is an eminent figure and, pilots, for example, I hear this all the time with UFOs that, a pilot said this, and pilots are, so perfectly credible and so forth. But J. Allen Hynek of the Center for UFO Studies did a study once. It's in his book and showed that of all the different eyewitnesses, pilots were about the worst. They're not what you think. That people think, oh, but a pilot's really... No, he's maybe a great pilot. He's not trained to identify UFOs. He just isn't. And even a plane that he knows very, very well, if he's moving at a speed and he sees something under peculiar atmospheric conditions that completely distort and make something look very different, he's just in the same boat you and I are in.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know what it is. But again and again, when people tell us that it's an extraterrestrial craft or a ghost, they're quite often you say, well, what's your proof? And they're saying, well, we don't know what it was. We have some glitch in our photo. We don't know what caused the mysterious white spot in our photo. Or we don't know what this was. And they're just arguing from negativity. They don't have an actual ghost, an actual flying saucer, or a nut or bolt from one. They probably don't have nuts and bolts, but yeah. You get my drift.
Well, you know, but I've talked to, for example, our investigator, Linda Moulton Howe, Joe, and, you know, she's an expert in crop formations. And we were talking several years ago, and I said, Linda, you know, of the hundreds and hundreds that you've investigated, and she believes that some of them are not man-made. We got into
it. Yes, I know, and she and I have a very different view, because
right.
I believe approximately 102% of them are. Man.
See, well, what I told her was, even if 99% were man-made, there's that 1% that we have no idea how they got here. But I guess where I'm headed for this is there's got to be a window there where even when you go to investigate something, there's not enough evidence there for you to conclude that it's a normal earthbound occurrence.
Well, It just remains unidentified.
Unidentified.
It just remains unknown.
Right. And until you can prove otherwise.
And this is where all the arguing and the, you know, the name calling and all the energy is spent. I mean, with UFOs, again, and I'm going to do a book on UFOs, and I'll get back to you then. But we're really talking about, you know, 5% or less of cases. I mean, my friends on the UFO side, the skeptics, all agree that 95% of UFOs can be relegated pretty easily into IFOs, identified flying objects. So we're arguing about
most
5%.
Of them. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
And, you know, the believers think that 5%, those are unexplainable, they say. No, they just mean they're actually just unexplained. Tomorrow we might find the missing piece of information and solve that cold case. And in fact, we do that quite often, find a new piece of evidence and propose a solution to an old case. So they're not unexplainable, they're just unexplained. And the idea that the 5% proves the existence of UFOs is just an argument from ignorance. It just is. Over and over, we get back to that same piece of logic that's faulty. Whereas, of course, the skeptics are saying, well, we're sort of assuming, and that's about all they can do, is we're assuming that if we knew the answer to all those cases in the 5%, they would probably just be the explanations for everything else. You know, they'd be, this one would be a secret U.S. aircraft, and this one would be a research balloon, and this one would be a prank, and so forth. That's the assumption that skeptics make. And nobody has proof or disproof of an actual extraterrestrial craft, or, to get back to my book that I'm trying to sell here, a ghost.
By the way, I understand you've got a 1-800 number you want to give out a little bit later on.
And yeah.
We will do that, so make sure you have that number handy, and we'll post it for you. I would assume a couple things, and we'll get right into the topic at hand here, Joe, that in terms of, let's say, climate change, I'm a believer in a cyclical Earth pattern. I think it happens. It happened once, happened twice. It's going to happen again. I would assume, because there's no definitive proof that it's mankind responsible for that, you would probably take that position as well, that maybe it's an Earth cycle and that climate change is not all man-made. Is that a pretty accurate guess?
Well, I haven't written a book on that.
No.
I'm not a scientist. And, you know, most people who are talking about climate change and getting into things are just reflecting a political position. And if people want to know about climate change and global warming, one should read our magazine. I can give that 800 number, and you can get a free copy. But we cover issues like that. But unless I've investigated it, I don't talk about the other guy's cases. I talk about the cases that for over 40 years I've investigated, and I'm a paranormal case investigator,
sure.
not a environmental scientist or any of a number of other things.
I would assume
you... I just assume the scientific consensus when I can find out what it is. I just accept that.
Sure. Can I assume you're an atheist because you don't have the proof yet?
Well, I am. I like to use not that term because that's a loaded, nasty term that people inflict.
I'm not doing it to attack you.
You know, they you say, know. "Oh, he's an atheist." I get this from the Shroudies all the time. And
let me rephrase that. You're more agnostic.
Well, I'll tell you what I am. I'm a secular humanist, and let me define that. That's an atheist with a heart. I was just talking to a famous New York imam, and he wrote in my book, you know, to the atheist with a heart, and that sort of prayed for me, you know, that the God I didn't believe in make himself known in my heart. And I thought that was pretty clever on the other side, but I'm looking at things, the whole world, everything. From the standpoint of we need evidence, and I get people all the time are asking me, do you believe in this word believe? Do you believe in God? Do you believe in ghosts? Do you believe in UFOs? Well, I believe in UFOs because that's just an unidentified in the sky. I've seen UFOs. I'm sure you have. We've all seen something. We didn't know what it was. But science is not in the belief business. But it doesn't matter what I believe. I could believe any of a number of things and wouldn't matter. My opinion wouldn't count. The question is, what do we have evidence for? And what can we prioritize and say, using, say, the rule of Occam's razor, that the best, simplest hypothesis with the fewest assumptions is most likely to be correct?
Is it easy,
and I'm
Joe?
I'm using that in every case, time and time and time again. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give you the best, most likely explanation, not one that I can absolutely nail down and say, you know, absolutely couldn't have been a leprechaun. No, I don't do that.
But at least you're open-minded and you're fair, and those are two critical aspects to this.
I try to be. I mean, I think that's exactly what we should do. We should use the scientific method, and that is open-minded, and science is, as you and I are talking this very moment, science is changing its opinion on something. I can almost, you know, just listen and hear it coming out of the silence. It would be something in medicine or something about particle physics, and science is just constantly tweaking and changing. But it's probably not going to just totally throw out all the previous knowledge of science. That's not going to happen tomorrow, I think. But little things, and they may have big implications. And I'm trying to, in that spirit of, okay, what's new? And science is self-corrective, and dogmas are not. When people have a dogma and they're raising their voice about something near hysteria, believing in some spiritualist or something, They're being dogmatic, and they are not using the scientific approach, which says, you know, we just need proof here, adequate proof. And that's what I'm looking for. Way out, I think that what I'm doing is I'm out on the very, very, very fringes of science, looking at those things that are intriguing and interesting. Do we live on after we die?
Oh, yeah, you're out there. So, Joe, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment and get into your work, The Science of Ghosts, next on Coast to Coast AM, this Independence Day. Hey, those of you in the greater St. Louis area, this coming Monday at the Tivoli Theater, I'm going to be there. There's a benefit for the Joplin Relief Fund. They're going to be showing a documentary that I participated in So if you're in the area, come on by. It's at the Tivoli Theater in St. Louis, 7 p.m. on Monday. I'll probably get there about 6:30 or so, and we shall do that. And then, of course, I'll be rushing back to the cave to do the program Monday night. But, again, come on by. We'll be back in a moment with Joe Nickel as we talk about his latest work, The Science of Ghosts, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Joe Nickel with us. Joe, tell us about the background for The Science of Ghosts and how you got into that area.
Well, it probably started, as I suggested, with my the death of my grandmother, which was when death really, as a boy, really presented itself to me. And other than that, I was, you know, just like every kid, I might dress up as a ghost for Halloween or something. But my work as a magician, I was resident magician at the Houdini Hall of Fame for 3 years. That was a museum of Houdini's possessions and a museum about him in Niagara Falls, Canada, since burned, tragically. But I worked in that museum, and Houdini had a career of exposing phony spiritualists and their tricks. And I got involved in that through my knowledge of Houdini, and pretty soon I was out, you know, sitting in a seance to contact the spirit of Houdini. And then in 1972, I went to my first haunted house, McKenzie House in Toronto. And it was a revelation to me. Here for some 10 years or so, various caretakers and others in the house would be lying abed in an upstairs back bedroom, and they would hear over there across the house where the staircase was, they would hear heavy thudding footsteps when there was no one in the house and the house was locked. And there were multiple ear witnesses who heard the footsteps on the stairs. There were a number of other things, mysterious piano music, strange photographs, you know, the kind of stuff that you hear about regarding haunted houses. And I found that next door to McKenzie House, and I found this by going there. You know, I don't live a virtual life and sit in front of a computer doing all my life's activities. I actually go on site all around the world. So I went to McKenzie House, and I found that next door was a building only 40 inches away with a parallel iron staircase. In other words, these two buildings had staircases against adjacent walls about 40 inches apart. And a late night cleanup crew or a caretaker's family going up and down that iron staircase. And of course, if you were in McKenzie House in a back bedroom, you heard right over there, and your ability to tell 40 inches of distance is non-existent, and particularly when the noisy staircase next door. So that was a revelation to me. I had explanations for the other phenomena. Caretaker's wife woke up one night and saw a man in a frock coat. She saw him, she convinced she was not dreaming, and she saw with her own eyes, saw a man standing by her bed, and then he disappeared. And that, I work with psychologists a lot and neurologists, and this phenomenon has been very well and very thoroughly studied, and that it's called a waking dream.
And explain that.
Well, when you and I are right now, we're both awake, and we're in the awake mode. And tonight when we sleep, we will, well, or in the day when we sleep, I know we're up late, when we sleep, we will be in the sleep mode, and our body and our minds will both be in the sleep mode, as now our body and minds are both alert and awake. What can happen is that you can get into a mode between sleeping and waking in which, let's say, and I'm greatly oversimplifying this, neurologists are probably, you know, squirming as I oversimplify this in layman's terms, but it'll make sense. When someone sleepwalks, their body's clearly awake because they're walking outside in their jammies, but they're asleep. Their mind
and they're functioning. I mean, there's part of their mind that's got to be awake, but or they'd get hit by a car or something.
Right, but by and large, the mind is asleep. in that mode. So they're sleepwalking. Now, flip that over. Exactly opposite to that, and you're lying in bed, and you wake up, and now you're seeing something, your dead father, an extraterrestrial, an angel standing beside your bed, and you're quite often in this mode, people are unable to move. And the reason they're unable to move is because the body, unlike, you know, in the case of sleepwalking, the body is still asleep. It's in the sleep mode, and you have no control over it. It's scary. People who've had this happen, I'm sure there are lots of people listening who've had this experience happen to them, and it's frightening. But you're awake to an extent, and though not quite, and you will swear that you were not dreaming. And that's true. In the normal sense of dreaming, you're not dreaming. So these mental states are absolutely essential. A lot of the alien abduction cases, when you ask people, why do you think you were abducted, they will tell you, and I've talked to many alien abductees and done extensive research in this field, but many of the cases people will say, well, I woke up and there were aliens standing around my bed, and they had must have had me tied down. I couldn't move. And then I don't remember what happened next. They must have erased my memory or something. Now, this is very common. And the same thing happens with ghosts, and that happened, a case like that, a report like that, at McKenzie House, a waking dream, I am sure, has all the hallmarks of a waking dream. Best explanation for what happened. So when I look at a case like McKenzie House, I went on site, and that case was just a revelation to me. I knew right then, this is what you do. You must actually go investigate. You must go on site, because this could never have been solved otherwise. And I thought, you'll find this amusing, I think. I thought if I did this, everybody would believe me, and they would love me for it. Didn't exactly happen that way. But, you know, you try. I mean, some people listen to my evidence and can relate to it and understand it and say, okay, that makes sense. And that's what I'm trying to do. But there are people who can't or won't.
Well, let's get into some of these investigations and things that happen. When you go on a site, specifically because we're talking about ghosts tonight, mm-hmm. What do you first do?
Well, let me say, because this is a very loaded area, let me say what I don't do. I don't do anything vaguely like what ghost hunters do. I have been with ghost hunters. I know the famous ghost hunters. I've been on various ghost hunts with people and helped them lug their fancy equipment, you know. They're carrying in, and they're talking about, oh, this has so many mega volts of whatever, and you know, they're swaggering as if they've got a, you know, 45 pistol strapped to them, and they're fascinated by equipment. But none of this equipment, not the electromagnetic field meters, not the thermal imaging cameras, not, you know, EVP recording tape recorders, nothing has anything to do with ghosts. It's absolutely, a fool's errand, and it's filled with folly. So none of those people are not detecting ghosts. They may be detecting themselves. Quite often, I think that's what they're doing, because there are, for example, electromagnetic fields everywhere. And, they may be detecting faulty wiring. They may be detecting a microwave tower somewhere in the distance, or they may be detecting their own electronic equipment, which they have in profusion. But the least, if you made a list of all the possibilities, at the bottom of the list would be a ghost, because we don't know that they have magnetic personalities. Right. That was a joke. I mean, so what I'm not doing is starting with the assumption that ghosts exist and that there's equipment that detects ghosts, and if we go in and we get the equipment to do something odd, we can say, well, we don't know why it did that. We don't know why the needle fluctuated. Must be a ghost, and that's the old argument from ignorance again. So that's just briefly, that's what I'm not doing. Because you imagine these ghost hunters, I mean, sometimes they do this rather literally, just sort of saying, Ma'am, just step aside, just stand aside while we bring in all this equipment, and we'll see if your house is haunted. And they're not paying any attention to the people who have called them there or who have experienced whatever. And what I'm doing is much more like, I hope, what crime scene investigators would be doing. I am, without any preconceived notions, I am arriving on this scene, maybe with nothing more than a pocket notebook.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I'm going to want to know at your house, George, what exactly is convincing you that your place is haunted. And I'm going to listen to you.
Do you stay there? Do you spend the
night?
Well,
I do when I can. I do spend the night. I've stayed in some of America's most haunted houses. It's not always possible. But, I stayed at the Myrtles Plantation, for example, courtesy of Discovery Channel. And when I can, I stay there. No necessary reason why ghosts, though, need to be in the nighttime. Why a nighttime spending the night is going to be better, but it's part of the folklore and part of the mystique of ghosts. But no evidence that any of the ghost hunting stuff works. So what I'm going to do is listen to the people, and if I can then look to a particular thing that's happened and try to explain it. So that at McKenzie House, I was focusing on those footsteps on the stairs. How to explain that? I didn't need to bring in electromagnetic field meters, you see, with an assumption that ghosts are doing it if I can get the meters to go off. That's just utter laughable nonsense, and it's not science. The equipment may be scientific. This is pseudoscience of a high order. But what I'm trying to do is just explain the footsteps on the stairs.
And Joe, let me ask you this. The Catholic Church has 120 priests dedicated to exorcisms. They teach classes.
An embarrassment to the church, I think. I feel sorry for them.
Well, tell me why, and then why would they create this department if they didn't think something demonic was happening?
Well, ignorance and superstition are widespread, and certainly scientists aren't looking for demons and spirits, because there's no scientific evidence that a single one exists. And so, yes, people claim that there are demons and spirits and ghosts and poltergeists and so forth, and so the church would have to answer for itself, but certainly the places I have been looking at such things, I have found reasonable explanations, no invisible entities of any kind, whether demonic spirit or leprechaun. And I've found, in the case of people who claim to be possessed, that psychological explanations are the way to go. And I've worked with psychologists in this field. Look, in the United States of America, in the 21st century, that anybody is out performing an exorcism and trying to convince somebody else that the devil is going to get you and that the devil's agents are possessing people is way, way, way off track.
Do you think the individual is just mentally ill?
Well, that remains to be seen. Look at a case, and some of these people are, for example, schizophrenic. But you can get people worked up, and you can get them to act out by suggestion. You've probably seen a stage hypnotist call some people up
and put them all under.
And does a little test, and some people don't play along, and they're sent back to their seats. But pretty soon you've got a group of people doing all kinds of things. And so when you see someone, say, religiously go under the power at a Benny Hinn faith healing service, and I've been there, it's everybody knows that when Benny Hinn gestures at them, they're supposed to, quote, go under the power. And these people have been selected because they've come to the
conclusion, the realization.
Pardon?
They're believers anyway.
That's right. They're believers, and they're self-selected because he's asked for people that have been healed or people who are, you know, and they come up. And so when he gestures at them, they know they're to go under the power, and everybody plays his own way. I mean, some stiffen and fall back into the arms of the catcher. Some people tremble, and some slump, and some fall on the floor and writhe and so forth. But kind of like when you and I were playing Cowboys and Indians, and I shot you, you know, you might grasp your chest and fall forward. Another one might be knocked back by the invisible bullet. And since sprawling, someone else might twitch a bit, and eyes
were good actors.
Closed.
We were good actors.
We were, and people do this without consciously. They get into the moment. They get into the role-playing. And possession can do the same thing. People could be told that there's a devil in them and get them worked up at a service and tell them that it's a demon that's causing them to smoke. And it's not that different from a hypnosis session in some ways. In any case, there is no scientific evidence that I've seen, no peer-reviewed, credible mainstream science evidence that demons exist. So I don't, you know, the church has to answer for itself, but they're using biblical writings from ancient times and mindset from ancient times, and they need to come into the 21st century, and in my opinion, and stop that.
What has been for you, Joe, the strangest thing you've investigated?
Ah, the strangest. Because there's a lot of strange stuff out there, as you know.
There sure is.
If anyone knows that, I think you know that. A lot of strange stuff. For me, I think one that, because some of the stuff, UFOs, ghosts, and so forth, fall into some rather familiar patterns pretty soon. And even if you don't know a particular case, you sort of recognize it as another haunting, you know. So it's not so strange when there are lots of those cases. But the cases that really mystified me initially years ago were cases of spontaneous human combustion. These cases of people who apparent reason and burn so incredibly thoroughly that in some cases they almost look like they were put in a crematorium.
Yeah.
And nearby objects, I mean, objects only a few inches away are not singed or damaged. And how is that possible? And some of these were bizarre deaths. And I looked at, with a forensic crime scene friend, we looked at 30 historical cases and over a period of about 2.5 years, proposed solutions for each of them, and then were able to draw generalizations from them. Not every case is the same, just as not all UFOs are weather balloons, of course. Not all cases follow, but there's a lot of similarity. You could have a sort of typical case of SHC, and the other cases would probably mostly be like that. And they have a real-world solution. People are not spontaneously combusting.
All right, well, stay with us, Joe. We're going to hit this break, and we're going to come back with you in just a moment as we talk about the science of ghosts. I'm George Norrie, and back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.